Welcome back to the Ignite podcast. Today, we're delighted to have Michael Tippy on the program. He's a seasoned biotech exec, venture capitalist, and he focuses on life sciences startups, which is not something we do at Team Ignite. So we wanted to have him on the podcast. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Would love to get an intro from you for the audience.
Sure. Well, I'm kind of a strange guy in the venture business in that our model is to start companies from scratch, from university technology. So, for example, I cut my teeth in this business with a guy named Larry Bock at Avalon Ventures. So I was at Norwest Venture Partners, which is now a $12 billion fund.
Yeah.
Larry probably is one of the premier, Larry's passed now, but he was one of the premier seed artists in life sciences. He did 22 companies worth over $100 billion today. Using this model, starting them from scratch, being the interim CEO oftentimes, and building them, and companies like Vertex, like Neurocrine, and Illumina, companies that are, you know, large multi-billion dollar public companies now. So
amazing.
It's hard work and it starts with science.
I love that. So you start with science. So walk us through how you got into that. I mean, what was kind of your origin story and
I started my career in the pharmaceutical industry under a guy who went on to build a very large company. John Martin is his name. He's also passed now. But we were at Syntex together and in the lab that developed one of the first antivirals, a drug called cancyclovir. And that's kind of how I got the bug to, you know, combine science and business for the greater good, and you know, hopefully if you make good and do good if you do this kind of stuff well.
Yeah. So let's unpack the I'm a strange guy in venture a little bit, because I like that phrase. How does venture differ and how is it strange and where you kind of dwell on it?
Well, first of all, most venture capitalists, I would say, are reacting to proposals that are sent to them instead of going out and, you know, talking to the knowledge creators and figuring out what is commercializable. So it's a very different way of thinking. Now, there are groups that do this, you know, Atlas, Third Rock. You know, I worked with all these groups.
Yeah.
And they
some of the bigger, well-known names. I know Kosla does this, kind of walks around Stanford and talks to the students there and writes $5 and $10 million checks into pre-launch, pre-rev companies.
Right.
That are just like basically, like you said, like a new technological breakthrough, new science, something.
Yeah, it's an idea usually with hopefully a patent application attached to it. I mean, there's got to be something proprietary because you've got to have defensible space.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, there's good times and bad. There's all kinds of ideas being created at universities. So our model is we put $300,000 to $500,000 in to de-risk something at the university stage into a university laboratory, typically.
This is like some postdoc student, researcher who's now they've tripped upon something, right? In the scientific process, they've discovered some novel way of solving a problem.
Right. And that usually takes a year, year and a half or so to hit, let's say, three technical milestones. The milestones usually are technical. And with that money, we want to show that, A, it's venture tractable, that this can be reduced to practice in a venture-relevant time frame. You know, we raise 10-year funds, maybe with three-year extensions. Pharmaceutical businesses, you know, $2 billion in a decade to develop a drug. It's already a force fit. So it has to be something that's venture tractable as opposed to, gee, you know, we should go write grants for the next 10 years. That doesn't work in the venture business. You know,
someday get to Mars or whatever. Like it's, that's a multi-decade thing. It's not venture tractable.
Yeah, that's lovely. And the government should finance that because it's basic research, but it's not something that you can, you know, reduce to the time value of money, which we have to deal with in the venture business.
Right.
So, you know, once that, if they pass that hurdle, oh, and by the way, if the founders, the technical founders are not crazy, because there's a lot of crazy in this business, flip side of genius is madness. Seriously.
I love that.
If they're not crazy and the stuff works and is venture tractable, then we'll go to the next stage, which is to put $3 to $5 million into the company, put in one of our venture partners who's, you know, very experienced entrepreneur, you know, who's an expert at this, you know, groping through a smoke-filled house stage, and spend the next, let's say, 2 years getting to the point where we can raise a Series A. And there's very, you know, very definite milestones that you need to hit to be able to raise a Series A with the conventional venture capitalism.
Yeah, especially in biotech and life science, that's just a little bit different animal. I think in B2B software, where we tend to play, you know, your million to 5 million of ARR, somewhere in there, growing fast. What does it look like?
Revenues are irrelevant in my business.
Right.
They're illegal. You cannot market a drug or medical device or diagnostic without FDA approval, right?
Right.
So revenues are completely irrelevant. What is relevant is time to FDA approval, the team, the market opportunity, the competitive matrix, that is the, you know, the IP, the monopoly space that you build around the technology to be allowed to, so that an exit is possible at the, yeah, future, right? So those are all the things that we think about.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So it's like the first $250,000 check. What is kind of that next milestone for the, for that $3 to $5 million check, and call it the seed? So you got this pre-seed check of $250,000. Mm-hmm. What is the milestone? You're trying to de-risk the craziness, you said, but what
de-risk
else?
De-risk the craziness, and then there's typically technical milestones. You have to design a series of experiments that will turn this deal or this technology from gray to black or white, we used to say at Norwest, right? So
what is it? What did you used to say?
We used to say we need to turn this deal from gray to black or white. Either,
oh, I love that. Okay.
Either pass, it's too risky, it will take too long, or yes, it's past the hurdle, it looks like it's venture tractable. We can, you know, in the next 3 to 5 years, we can get this thing to market, to strategic alliances with a big company, to something that will point the way to an exit.
Mm. And then what are some of the things that you kind of look for in that first phase to write that next $3 million check?
Well, again, it's a series of milestones that will lead to FDA approval or get you down the pathway. For a medical device, it had better be FDA approval, and that's a 510K or de novo, not a PMA, usually. If it's a pharmaceutical, you want to be able to get to an IND that is the first in human approval by the FDA to allow you to go into humans at the very least, because the value inflection points in pharmaceuticals are very, very different than any other business. You know, by the time you get to the clinic, there's maybe six to eight percent chance of getting a drug approved, right?
Are we talking about phase one trial approval?
Time you get to phase one, there's a 6 to 8% chance.
Wow. So you got all the way to phase one and it's still 6 to 8%. Probability that you go all the way through.
Maybe it's 10, maybe it's 6, somewhere in that range.
So, low probability.
So you better have mutually independent probabilities for shots on goal, right? I mean, if you have three things that are dependent on the same things, like...
You're talking about portfolio construction from a venture capital perspective.
Right. Well, I'm talking about a drug strategy that will allow you to get to some reasonable prospect of a drug that will be approved or be partnered. And to do that, you've almost by definition got to have multiple shots on goal. That's why one-trick ponies are very rarely financed in the venture business.
So basically when you're assessing it, you're kind of looking at this new compound or new technology, new breakthrough. And you're saying, hey, there's multiple ways to win here. There's multiple paths to revenue, to the FDA approval.
Right.
There's multiple uses for the drug.
Yeah. So that devolves from the science by saying, for example, okay, we have a series of drug leads which act on a particular active site of an enzyme, which is biologically active. Okay. And these different leads act in different ways on that active site. So there's sort of several ways to get to success, to efficacy.
Love that.
Yeah.
What have you've been doing this for a while? Like, what kind of changes have you seen in this process over the last decade or so, or two decades, whatever timeline makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, Well, first of all, in order to take a company public, well, the markets are closed right now, right? Nobody's going public.
Right.
But when the markets are open, in general, you have to have something that is in the clinic or a portfolio of drugs or medical devices that are in the clinic. It's not okay anymore to have an idea and a few mice studies and, gee, we're going to take this public. That does not work anymore, with the exception of a few bucket shop kind of highly risky things I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole strategies. In order to support a public company in this space, you've got to have a lot, you've got to, almost by definition, you've got to have something that is very close to or in the clinic.
What is the success rate, for B2B SaaS, the unicorn rate, depending on what data source you look at is, these are billion-dollar outcomes from the pre-seed is 1% to 2%. Is it similar in biotech? Is it a similar kind of hit rate, or is it higher or lower?
I have no idea. That's a function of, are we talking venture-backed companies? Are we talking...
Let's take the whole universe of all, biotech seed investments or pre-seed. What is the likelihood to get to that billion-dollar outcome? Because if it hits, it hits big, right? Like these are
if it hit
billion-dollar, billions of revenue.
Particularly in pharmaceuticals, it's big. Now, medical devices, it's a little different because you've got an oligopoly of acquirers. And so that has depressed acquisition prices. So in a biotech company, success is a $2 to $5 billion company, let's say.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a public company at the exit, most likely, or be acquired.
Right.
And there are lots of examples of exits that are bigger than that. But for a device company, I'd say a good exit is, $300 to $500 million kind of exit. Mm-hmm. So, there are smaller exits, but in devices, they're not as risky. I would say there's, 40 to 60% chance of success in devices by the time you get to the clinic, their first in human studies.
Oh, interesting.
Contracts.
A little more de-risked.
Yeah. So it's less risky, but the exits are lower, and you've got this oligopoly of acquirers problem that has made a lot of venture capitalists shy away from devices.
Interesting. What are some medical devices that did have a lot of success that we might know of?
Well, for example, I've invested in a heart failure company, and there's a company that makes the Impella device, which is kind of the success story you talk about in this business. It's $18 billion exit.
Wow.
That's
significant.
Yeah.
Especially if you wrote the pre-seed check, right?
That's right. And that breaks my rule for, devices not being as remunerative as pharmaceuticals. That blows it all to smithereens.
Right. Well, there's always the exception, right? There's kind of the rule, the average, and then there's kind of always outliers. When you're writing that first $250K into these pre-company companies, what you might call them, like what's the typical valuation? Are you
getting an idea and a professor? The valuation, well, sometimes you do it on a note because it's hard to set the valuation. Other times, the valuation could be, anywhere from $1 to $5 million pre.
Yeah. That's typically pre-launch kind of valuations over in B2B SaaS land as well. It's like, you got an idea, you got some new technology, but you don't have any team or revenue or product yet.
Right.
You're probably getting like a 2 cap, 2.5 cap kind of valuation. And that's if you can raise any money at all. And that's typically, we might call that over here on the B2B SaaS side of things, like a friends and family round or an angel round.
Sure.
Before you get that first pre-seed, which is 2.5 to 10 cap kind of range. Now you got a product, got some revenue, things like that. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your involvement with Berkeley Skydeck. I mean, I went there for grad school. I think that's how we originally got connected. And what do you see coming out of Berkeley? That's exciting.
Well, I'm a BioTrack advisor at the Berkeley Skydeck. Actually, I'm spending a good part of the day tomorrow. This is really community service. I don't have any financial involvement. It's trying to help UC Berkeley and the Skydeck Fund select and then advise companies. So typically, for example, I'm on the selection committee for all the buyout stuff. There's, you know, another, I don't know, 10 or so of us who built these companies that are in similar situations and try to help. So we screen the initial decks that are sent in and score them. And then, for example, tomorrow we're going to first round interviews. So that there's, you know, 25 companies that we're talking to. They got 20 minutes to pitch. And then we talk about, you know, should we take this one? Should we take that one?
It's and a lot once, of pitches, 20 minutes times 25 companies. It's,
yeah.
You're so then, for a while.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's an all day thing. It's a marathon.
It's like 8 hours. Yeah.
Right. And then once that's done, and we make our selections, then, you know, Berkeley Skydeck Fund will invest, you know, $100,000 to $250,000 in these companies,
yeah,
and select a group of advisors. Okay. And I'm an advisor at two of their companies in this cohort. I've done as many as four before, and there's three cohorts a year typically. So, you know, you've got 3 months to try to help these companies and, you know, help get financed, help them with their strategy, help attract people, all this stuff.
Yeah. That's so awesome.
It's a lot of work for, you know, volunteer stuff, but, you know, it's a way to give back.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's always, and I've done a few of those as well over the years with the Alchemist Accelerator and a couple others where.
And I have invested in a couple of the companies that I have advised. The rule is you can't be compensated or invest during the tenure of the Berkeley Skydeck engagement, which is 3 months. But after that, you know, they want to do a deal with you, that's fine.
What are some of the promising things on the horizon in life sciences that you're excited about?
Oh. Well, for example, the whole metabolics developments, Ozempic, Mojerno, you know, these weight loss drugs, those are
life changing.
Yeah, life changing. And I'm invested.
I have many, many friends. Everybody knows people now that lost 20, 30, 50 pounds on
right
semaglutide, GLP-1s.
Yep. So, for example, right now I'm advising for Berkeley Skydeck, a company out of UC Berkeley that has, you know, one of these or family of these analogs that look very promising. You know, they work on a different set of enzymes, but they're orally active. They're look to be non-toxic. There's extensive
growth. So you don't have to inject. You don't have to inject. You can just take a pill.
Right. Right. And they don't. Then they. It looks like they have, you know, many fewer side effects than the currently marketed drugs. So, you know, you can imagine there's the companies that are currently in that business, Lilly, Novo, and others, Merck, Pfizer, are keenly interested in looking at these things. But they're not going to do a deal with this little company until there's more data, you know, monkey data, not rats, monkeys, you know.
You start with rats and go to monkeys? Is that typically...
Well, I mean, it depends on the drug system and what is the accepted animal model. It could be, I've worked on projects where the accepted animal model is pigs, sheep, dogs. The company I used to run, you know, we had data in 500 monkeys at the Primate Center in Oregon. So, monkeys are pretty good. Monkeys are really, really expensive. They're more expensive than graduate students.
But the data is really, really good.
Yeah. Right. Right. So,
we've all been waiting for this diet pill, right? I mean, you know, we've had false prophets in this space now for decades, right? That turns out like it harms your heart and, you know, or whatever. And so we finally have
the thing where crisis, right?
All that stuff that happened in the 70s and 80s. So we seem now to finally have this weight loss drug that is like a magical cure to lots of maladies that are imposed by our Western society. It's a really exciting time.
Yeah. So that's an area that, you know, for example, 5-7 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to get pharmaceutical interest in a metabolomics project. There's all kinds of interest now, believe me.
You know what's interesting about the semaglutide? Because I looked into it because everyone would like to lose a little weight. You know, the pharmacy's like, well, we can go with the Ozempic, but it's $1,000 a month. Or we do this compound where we just take the semaglutide and kind of mix it with some like B vitamins, and it's $270 a month. Why can they do that? Like, what's the patent law around this and generics and compounds? And
actually, I don't think I'm qualified to speak on that because I'm not sure why that's legal. I'm sure that Novo has a patent on semaglutide. I mean, yeah. When I read the report in the New England Journal, I was thinking, holy shit, this is revolutionary. Yeah. That wasn't that long ago. So,
I mean, how long do you get a patent for? So like I discover a compound, I think it's promising. I file the patent, you know, is it 20 years, 25 yeah. years? What's the clock on it?
Yeah. 20 years. I mean, if you're have sophistication, you can do product line extensions and, you know, extend that patent franchise. But that's absolutely critical because, I mean, the minute a drug goes generic, you know, the price goes down by a factor.
Yeah, it's aspirin, 10. Basically. Yeah, yeah,
right. Exactly. So, you know, drug companies work very hard to try to keep, you know, monopoly position as long as possible.
Yeah. Now,
one could argue that's not in society's best interest because, I mean, when you run the numbers about how many people are obese,
right?
Everybody taking semaglutide at $1,000 a month. You, I mean, it's yeah, like gross national what? Product. So, I mean, that's another reason to have other entrants in the field. Hopefully there gets some competition, you know, reduce the price point.
That's what like the government, I read a headline. I don't even think I read the article on this one. I just saw it on my Google feed or whatever, but it was, economists are studying the GDP impacts of Ozempic, whereas people are living longer, having less disease, and being more productive and paying more taxes,
right?
Because they're healthier. So right. Yeah, you have to kind of like, as a government, you kind of go, well, maybe.
But let's see, a third of us are obese. $1,000 a month. Run those numbers real quick. It's a lot. Scary.
Yeah, that's $100 million times 1,000. Whatever.
Yeah, right.
It's a big number per month.
Right.
So on
the device side, I'm very excited about some things. Like for example, I invested in the last year in a company involved with heart failure. They've got a device that is now in human beings, being in their first in man studies in Europe. And it's shown a 30-40% increase in ejection fraction in these critically ill heart failure patients. Mm. And that's a situation where the drug treatment is, in many cases, not satisfactory. I mean, you're on a witch's brew of drugs. I mean, I have a family member who died, but you know, had this disease. I saw the progress, and it's a nightmare. I mean, you're in the OR. I mean, you're in the ER periodically. Urgent care, adjusting all this, you know, these 10 different drugs you got to take, diuretics and beta. And it's not well managed using pharmaceuticals currently. So that is a good argument for a device approach. And this one's pretty interesting.
Interesting.
I mean, so a 30% increase in heart fraction.
What is that for non-biological technical people?
That means the difference between barely being able to get up to go to the bathroom and being able to do normal activities of living, walk around your house.
So your heart now can just pump enough blood for you to live a normal life versus I mean, get tired just getting up.
Right. Exactly. So that's a big improvement in quality of life, in productivity, in my view, certainly investing at the stage I do, you have to see these big improvements. It can't be incremental. It has to be revolutionary. And attacking some unmet problem in medicine, providing a solution to justify the very large risk you take investing where I do.
Yeah. What do you think? I want to return to the patent question a bit, because you talked about timelines from a patent being 20 years. And I want to talk about the extension and figure out what that is. But first, let's talk about the semaglutide, for instance. When did they file that patent, and how many years do they have left? And how long does it take to get through all the FDA approvals? What is that window of profitability then for these biotech companies?
Well, that's a good question. That's a very individualized answer, because how long it takes to get through the FDA process depends on the difference between how you power the study. right? So it comes straight out of statistics, right? If you have a large difference between control and test, you need fewer samples to get statistical significance.
You got a better p-value, basically.
Right. But if you have a very narrow difference, then you need large. That's why, like a lot of cardiac drugs, you know, there's narrow therapeutic difference. You know, you need 10, 20, 50,000 patients. I mean, Pfizer can't afford that. I mean, a little biotech company, good luck.
Yeah. And so you're kind of looking at this as an investor in the earliest, like somebody probably looked at semaglutide and is like, whoa, that is really effective. And let's get after it.
Right. Right. And of course, it has to be safe too. So, you know, I mean, can be effective as efficacy, all get out. If it poisons somebody, that's no good. So, and there's a whole series of preclinical, you know, experiments you have to do, pharmacology, toxicology, fate distribution, metabolism, all that stuff has to be done. You know, we do not put poison in people to test. No, you don't do that anywhere in the world, nowhere.
Right. And so what the animal choice here is usually like mice to start?
Usually rodents to start.
Rodents, yeah.
And then some larger animal, the FDA requires two species at the least in order to present, you know.
Like lambs or goats, like bigger animals.
Yeah, it just depends. I mean,
yeah.
For example, in cardiac, you know, you often use pigs because their heart is actually fairly similar to ours.
Wow.
And sheep, no. Dogs, not so good. Pigs, really good. Mm. But it depends on the disease state and the accepted animal models.
So let's return to the patent question. So semaglutide's up in 20 years. You know, typically, you know, sometimes what's the fastest you can get through FDA approval versus like kind of the longest for a successful drug that you know of? What's that kind of time range?
Well, gee. I mean, it depends. It depends on whether you're talking devices or drugs. For devices, you can do a 510K, which is basically saying there's a predicate device that is similar and has been approved. You can piggyback on that and get those through in 6 months. I mean, you got to do probably a year, at least a year.
Interesting. So you got a longer profitability window with that patent on that novel device. Right. You could have a 18, 19 year window there of profitability where nobody can copy you.
Mm-hmm. Although I would argue that patents are stronger in pharmaceuticals because you're looking at composition of matter, a unique chemical entity, as opposed to a device thing, which one could maybe engineer around patent around.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's, I mean, you need a patent attorney to analyze this stuff. It's complicated.
Which I'm sure as a venture investor, you have, you know, your team, right? You have people looking at that.
Yeah. I mean, we work routinely with a patent agent, and you know, who's, you know, well-trained in science and on the law. And then, you know, before we would do a deal, we'll do a deep dive with a patent attorney.
Yeah. And, what about on the drug side? So what's the fastest and what's the kind of the longest that makes sense? The longest that you can remember?
Oh, I don't know. Well, I mean, typically, deals I'm looking at, you're looking at least 2 years of preclinical work. And that's typically when you come to those projects, there's been a lot of academic work. There may be rodent work. There may be, you know, pharmacology, toxicology that's been done in the university. Okay, already. That could have been on grants, could have been for 10 years, right? But at the point at which there's, you know, it looks like it might actually be a drug, you're looking at least 2 years of preclinical work, typically, before you can get to the clinic. And then in the clinic, you know, there's three phases, phase one, phase two, phase three. Phase one is safety, by and large, and they're fairly small studies. These are, you know, 10 to 50 patients. And phase two is efficacy. And phase three is larger studies in dose ranging. So probability, see, this gets to why drugs are so difficult. Probability of success in phase one is about 2/3, about 67, 70%. Probability of success in phase two is about 30%.
Wow. And these probabilities multiply, right?
That's so you get correct.
2/3 times 1/3 now.
That's correct. Probably getting through phase 3 is about 80%. So you can see that phase 2 probability is the hurdle. And that's why the overall success rate is only 6 to 10%. It's because you've got this, you know, this nested series of probabilities with a very low number in the middle.
Yeah. So people get upset about the cost of these prescriptions and drugs and devices, but I think what people fail to realize is all the research money that went into creating this, all the failed dead ends.
Yeah,
you have to recoup all that R&D.
I mean, look, when I was at MIT, we modeled the pharmaceutical industry based on equations that were developed for wildcatting for oil. Mm. Right, this is incredibly risky stuff. And the thing is the money spent goes up like this, and then you've got this low probability event in the middle. So, look, if I came to you and told you, I got a great business idea, right? All you got to do is spend, you know, $2 billion in 10 years, and you got a 6% chance of developing a drug. You'd say you're out of your mind, right? From a conventional investment point of view, why would anybody do that?
Not a single one. Yeah, I wouldn't do. You have to as a VC, or like invest in dozens, if not hundreds, of these things over the years.
So
to make it make sense,
right?
Yeah. So for a company like Merck or whatever. Yeah.
Right. So as an investor, you're not looking at ultimate success in the marketplace as the metric. Your metric for exit is when a big drug company takes it over, right? Because there's typically, you know, a strategic alliance involved. By the time you get through phase 2, you pretty much know the story. If you get through that hurdle, you probably got a drug, right? And you can start doing discount cash.
4 out of 5 times.
Yeah, right.
But that's like Series B typically, right?
Could be Series C.
Really far down.
Could be far down the line, right. If it's Series G, you're you know, my
a lot of dilution.
My investment's flushed. I'm diluted out of existence.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the guys that come in at that most recent round, they get all the value. So that's not a success.
Well, yeah. What are some of that pref stack stuff that happens on the biotech side? I know about some of the stuff on the B2B side. You know, typically
these days, we're a nuclear winter right now for biotech and life science, right? I mean, we haven't had a public market for 2 years. Valuations are way down. Nobody can, it's very, very difficult to raise a venture fund. There's just all kinds of systemic problems. So pay to plays have come back, cram downs, down rounds. It's...
What's a pay to play? For the audience.
Well, for example, if you're an investor at an earlier stage and now the company wants to raise another round, new investors come in and say, okay, you early investors, if you want to maintain your position in this company, anything close to it, you've got to up your ante, right?
Yeah.
In the poker analogy, right?
You're basically recapping this company
exactly.
At a different valuation. Yeah.
And if you don't want to invest your pro rata share, then Mr. Investor, you're going to own 1% of what you used to.
Wow.
Yeah, it's harsh.
You just get flushed out.
Yeah, it's very harsh.
And they can do that. They can strong arm the cap table in this case, because they're holding all the cards. This company needs this lifeline to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't get this capital infusion, the company goes out of business and you have what's 1% of nothing, right? Basically.
Right. So, that's one of the key risks of the seed business is getting diluted out of existence. Mm-hmm. And you have to select companies that minimize that risk, frankly. I can't invest in a company that needs, $500 million of venture capital to get to an exit because the probability of me getting flushed out is high.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Because at one point down the line, I'm going to have that conversation with a big investor like Norwest, where I used to be.
Yeah.
We really appreciate your hard work, but
Thanks for finding this company and getting them to the stage, but now you're out.
Right.
That's really interesting.
Thanks for all your hard work. We'll take it from here. I've heard that one
before. How often does that happen? Is that just a kind of a market cycle thing, or is that there's a percentage of time that it's always going to happen?
It happens more often in down times like this. I mean, I've been through 4 of these downturns now in my career in business. And, when it's like this, ugly stuff happens, you know.
The sharp elbows come out, as they say.
Yeah. You know, and now I'm the prey. Yeah. Not the predator.
Yeah, it is. It is a. It can be a kind of a messy, sharp-elbowed kind of business. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, in good times, you know, these things go away.
Yeah.
But in bad times, the sharp elbows come out. That's for sure.
Yeah. What about a cram down? Can you explain that for the audience?
Well, for example, let's say this is commonly happened in the last couple of years, right? So during the pandemic. There was a lot of froth. There was a lot of venture investment, right? Companies got financed at high valuations.
So 100X.
Yeah, 100X, whatever. Let's say you got a company that just did a deal 2 years ago at an $80 million valuation.
Okay. 80?
Yeah, let's say that. $80 million pre-money valuation. Now, of course, they want to go out and do an up round, like $120 million valuation. Right? So you get a term sheet from the big guys that says, all right, we'll do this deal at $30 million pre.
Oof.
Yeah. And everybody gets crammed out. Management, everybody.
So everybody's basically taking a huge dilution on their investment. So you thought you had 10% of the company, but at the new valuation, you have something like 1/3 of what you thought.
Right.
So because it's a price down.
But then again, there are times when, hey, that beats death. Metaphorically, it beats having to pack it in and take the company bankrupt.
Yeah.
You know?
And in biotech, that probably happens even more than B2B SaaS, right? Because in B2B SaaS, you can basically go, well, I didn't hit my milestones, but I can trim the fat and get profitable or be default alive, right? Because there's some recurring revenue. In biotech, it's like, well, we're entering phase two.
Right.
And if we don't raise this money, we can't get through phase two and we're dead.
Yeah, money is the fuel in the rocket ship in life sciences. No money, no liftoff.
Would you say life sciences has bigger rewards, though? Are the outcomes bigger, or they're just similar?
I don't do IT, so I have no idea. Yeah. But my sense is that, when there's a hit, there's a big hit. I mean, an $18 billion exit in a device company, for example. They're in Seattle, where you are, CGen was acquired for what was it like?
I'm actually technically from Seattle. I'm in California.
Ah.
Yeah. I'm east of Sacramento now.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Is that Shasta behind you in the picture?
No, that's Glacier Peak. That I had a cabin near North Cascades National Park when I lived in Seattle. And that's a hard hike to get to that place, Image Lake. That's a good day's scramble, but it's a gorgeous, gorgeous place.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to switch and do some rapid fire to wrap up, if that's all right.
Sure.
What's one book that has profoundly impacted your life, professionally or personally, or both?
A book that's affected my life. Well, that's interesting. Probably... some of the things I read at MIT, at the Sloan School. So, for example, Strategic Management by Cusmano or Porter or Negotiation. I took a negotiation class from
a
fellow there.
Went to Sloan then?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember my negotiation class. It was really good. Power and Politics was a really good class. I remember reading.
Yeah.
A lot of great books from that class, and
so those were influential. I mean, Lao Tzu, The Art of War is another one that's more philosophy than anything, but it applies.
Always good to business. For a reread or a re-listen that book because it's kind of short and just so poetic and poignant, just exacting detail on strategy and war strategy.
Yeah, and then on the science side, things like. The conceptual development of quantum mechanics or, that interface of science and philosophy, which is highly mathematical, but highly philosophical, is very interesting and relevant.
It's kind of an oddball question. What year do we reach longevity escape velocity? Meaning we're adding a year of life to our biological lives every year?
Oh, that's a function of so many things. I mean, you know, telomeres, cell biology, fundamental limits. I don't know. I mean, besides, would you want to live forever? I mean,
I'd want to choose, I think, right? I would like to live forever, and I would like to, I'd like to see the secrets of the universe and have the time and the resources to explore all different aspects of life. I'd love to like be able to go back and be a biotech engineer or a research scientist, you know, like if I knew like, oh, well, we just got some sort of breakthrough and now people are living to be hundreds of years old. Like, well, I got time to do whatever, you know, I want. I could go be a DJ, make hip hop beats, and I could go, you know, like reinvent myself over and over again.
It would be nice. I don't think, I think that's above my pay grade. I'm not competent to, I mean, you need to assemble a room full of Nobel laureates to get any kind of intelligent speculation even on that.
That's an interesting question. Kind of in the same vein, what's a breakthrough in biotech you hope to see in the next decade or life sciences generally?
Well, what I would like to see is a solution to some of the most intractable problems in cancer. So, for example, pancreatic cancer, glioblastoma, brain cancer, and ovarian cancer are the three diseases that have for decades now just eluded us. And these are horrible diseases that take people in the prime of their life. And I mean, look, breast cancer is a solvable problem by and large now.
Right.
Pancreatic is a death sentence. I mean,
it just metastasizes too quickly and just spreads too quickly,
It's too late. So, for example, I have a strong interest right now in finding diagnostics for pancreatic and ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
Because if you can catch it early, you can treat it, right? You can cut out the tumor. But, I mean, for example, in ovarian, I spent 3 years of my life on that, developing a diagnostic. And the problem is, you know, a woman comes in, her, you know, belly's out to here. She thinks she's gained weight. And in fact, she's full of ascites, this liquid fluid that cancer cells get off, and it's everywhere. And
oh no,
say your prayers.
It's too late.
You know, you got 6 months to live. It's that kind of discussion so with sad. Your physician. But if you had a blood test where you could detect a few cancer cells while they're localized, then you could treat it.
Right.
Chemo, radiation.
What about the whole body scanning? You know, I've heard of these like $2,000 or $3,000, basically they run you through a body scan and so they could detect all this stuff.
Yeah, actually
it makes sense for people to do that every year.
Well, if you have the money, I mean, I am thinking, I am thinking myself about doing this. I've had discussions with my doctor because my mother died of pancreatic cancer. Okay. In her 70s.
Wow.
And if you could detect this using an MRI scan, and I know some examples where that has occurred.
Yeah.
Again, you do a surgery.
You catch it in stage one and just, okay, great.
Right. Take
it out.
Well, I mean, it's not simple. I mean, the Whipple surgery is the biggest surgery we have in cardiothoracic surgery. That's the one you would go to. But you got a shot of living. You don't with now you're diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. You got 6 months to live. Go put your affairs in order. You got that's it.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So yeah, that would be a huge advance. But the trouble with those things, even the scans right now, is they gin up a whole bunch of false positives. Right. So great, you do the whole body scan. You've got 30 things to chase to ground. Right. And that could be very expensive, those follow-up tests.
Yeah.
And very frustrating to the physician, frustrating to the patient, and a lot of cost to the healthcare system. Right. So it's not just $1,000 or $1,500 for the MRI scan. It's the maybe $10,000 or $20,000 to follow all this stuff up. Right. Does that make sense on a population basis? Sure. It makes sense for me.
Yeah. If you have the money.
On a societal level. You got to think hard about that.
Yeah. But maybe what's great about technology and why I'm in tech is things get, you know, twice as good at a very predictable rate, right? You know, scanning technologies, you know, everything kind of starts becoming this information technology that, you know, we develop better ways of doing everything. So maybe in the future, it's pretty standard to get the yearly like whole body scan and find stuff very early, you know?
It could be. I mean, I have a colleague in the venture business, actually a very well-known venture capitalist, who's doing just this. He went into Stanford Hospital with 5 years of longitudinal data. They found something. They did surgery. He's got a family history.
Nice.
Maybe it makes sense.
We're looking into it. I mean, I'm starting to get to that age now, you know, in my mid 40s, where I'm like, okay, maybe, you know, every 5 years, every 3 years, you know, whatever makes sense. And
right. But if you're every 2 weeks, then for the next year, following up with your doctor on false positives, you might have a different story to tell.
Yes. Yeah. Because you got to wonder what the false positive rate is.
Yeah. And it's not just the money. It's the worry. It's the time. It's the, you know, oh my
yeah,
God,
speaking of worry, I like this question. Yeah, I like this question, which is, you know, you said 6 months to live. Would you rather know you have 6 months to live or just suddenly die?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Depends. I mean, pancreatic is so painful. I think I'd rather just die. Just
instantly die.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. We couldn't control the pain with my mother, and my sister's a physician. Oh. And, you know, we had all kinds of, you know, stuff at our control.
Just could not. Yeah.
It's a horror show.
What if it's like, you know, you're going to die someday and it's going to be painless 6 months from now versus.
Oh, yeah, of course. Sure. I'd want the time. And I think, you know, the time becomes more precious the less you have of it.
Right. Yeah. Speaking of time, if you could go back in time and give yourself advice to your 20-year-old self, what would that advice be? Your family's going to love this podcast someday. They're going to watch it.
Finish my PhD in chemistry because I left with a master's degree and then went to business school and so on. But in science, PhD is your union card, and you really are not considered a real scientist until you've attained that goal.
How do you think it would have impacted your career? How do you think it, you know, counterfactually would have turned out different? You think you'd just still be doing what you're doing now, or
I'd be doing what I'm doing more confidence now, but it would have opened up some more options for me, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I have a master's degree in chemistry. I've got, you know, many different continuing education courses in science and, you know, proteomics, genomics, pharmacology, immunology, and so on and so forth. But not having a PhD doing what I do is an issue. Less of an issue now at this stage of my career, but you know, in my 30s and 40s, it was an issue.
I feel that as a venture capitalist, a fellow VC, you know, I never had a successful exit at any of my startups. I mean, you know, I kind of, you know, that's maybe my regret, is not founding a company that raised a bunch of capital and had to exit. That's the one thing I haven't done. But I don't know if it has any bearing on my ability to allocate capital, but it's a regret, you know?
Yeah. Well, it has bearing in terms of being able to relate to entrepreneurs, I think, and get premier deal flow.
Yeah.
On the West Coast, you're respected for having a hit, you know? It's just the way it is. And
Totally.
Fortunately, I did that, you know, sold a company in 2016 that's, you know, very successful, multi-billion-dollar, 11 drugs in the clinic, and so I've got that talking point when I talk to entrepreneurs and scientists. I can say, look, I've done it. I've been there, you know, I don't want to do it again. Work 100 hours a week. but I can help you a lot. It's like, now I've got the cred to coach.
Yeah.
Play to coach.
Yeah. Well, hopefully some of my startups will break out and I'll be able to tell a story of like,
I'm sure they will. You know,
they have, you know, some already have, but you know, and I was a product manager for years, and I've built lots of products, and I never did the full on founder badge of honor, you know. Speaking of startups, let's talk about anti-portfolio. What's a startup that maybe you passed on that you're like, oh, I shouldn't have passed on that?
Shouldn't have passed on it.
Yeah, or do you have any of those? Or
not as a venture capitalist, but as an executive, I was asked to be, after Syntex, I was asked to be the number 15 guy at Amgen, which is now, you know, hundreds of billions of dollar company, right? And I passed to be able to stay in Seattle and marry my first wife, that I'm divorced from longer now. That wasn't a very good financial decision.
I have one like that too. That's now, you know, worth probably close to $10 billion. I was going to be first product hire, you know, right. Employee number like 8, 9, 10, something like that.
Right. But, you know,
probably worth tens of millions of dollars right now.
Shoulda, yeah. Coulda, woulda, you know. And the other thing is, yeah. how many milkshakes do you really need to drink, you know?
As long as you enjoy what you're doing and who you're doing with it, doesn't
exactly.
really matter.
Yeah.
It's just fun to kind of. What's one habit that helps you stay productive?
Rowing. So for me, maintaining very good physical condition is critical to maintain the kind of energy it takes to do these early stage things. So I've been a competitive rower now for 30 years.
Oh, wow.
You know, I go to Orange.
Probably read Bowie's in the Boat then.
Oh, of course.
Such a good story. Yeah. I'm a UW undergrad, so I had to read it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I didn't row when I was at the UW, but I did after I went to Boston and, you know, came back.
You went to UW as well?
Oh, yeah. I got my master's degree there, chemistry.
Oh, amazing.
And then did a bunch of other, you know, immunology, genetics. I get my advisor in chemistry got mad at me because I was taking all these biology courses. But, you know, I knew the action is at the interface of these disciplines. Chemistry is an old discipline now.
Right. Yeah. Well, and a lot of the breakthroughs come from cross-disciplinary experts.
Right.
It's kind of like you can combine this with that and see it in a different way.
Right. Academics is not usually very good at that. They exist in silos in their departments, you know.
Right.
So, but in drug development, you've got to combine those things.
If you weren't in venture capital or biotech, what career would you have pursued?
Well, I'd probably be a jazz guitarist. I mean,
I love that.
I went to, before Sloan, I deferred my admission for a couple of years and went to the Berklee School of Music.
And did you really?
Yeah. And played music. And I play now. It's just,
it's amazing.
It's a wonderful, you know, wonderful hobby, but a very sad profession. What's a musician without a girlfriend? I mean, homeless.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. Or drug addiction, or something. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's you know, wonderful stuff, creative, but no market.
Yeah. Last question. If you could have dinner with any scientist or entrepreneur, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Probably Bob Swanson, who you know, was the initially venture capitalist, then CEO of Genentech.
Wow.
So.
And why him?
Well, because he was one of the first, probably maybe the first, because he came out of MIT like I do, so we probably have a few things in common, that kind of worldview. And he was like the seed capitalist in a completely new industry, to boldly go where no man has gone before. I mean,
you're a Trekkie too. I mean, how many things do we have in common? I'm rewatching The Next Generation with my teenage boys now, which is awesome. You know, because I grew up, I was a teenager in the 90s when Next Generation was out. And
oh yeah, I think that's why I studied chemistry, Star Trek, you know. And
I love that.
Yeah, it was. Now I'm
watching any of the new series.
Oh yeah, sure.
They're pretty good.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, Star Trek is wonderful.
It's great.
And I think it's done a lot to popularize science and engineering. So,
yeah.
I'm not the only scientist, engineer, you know, investor, entrepreneur who says that.
That's the Enterprise right there.
Yeah.
Right at the end of my finger.
Is it?
Yeah. it's really small. I need to get a bigger one, but yeah, it's like probably 5 inches. But
yeah, but I mean, you know, that whole ethos of to boldly go where no man has gone before is really important if you're going to take the kind of risk that we do.
Mm.
You know, because there are failures. There are lots of failures, but the key is to you know, cut your losses early and let your winners run. Keep investing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I like that phrase in investing. Let your winners ride. Yeah. Love that.
Yeah, I mean, because if you're not failing to some extent, you're not taking enough risk.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's what I tell, you know, people on Team Ignite, my LPs, is hey, half of these are going to zero. We just don't know which half.
Right.
Right. You know, we're going to make educated bets on what we believe to be true. But right. Fundamentally, I mean, half this stuff is going to zero. And even more in right. biotech, it sounds like.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, there's a fair bit of living dead zombie companies.
Yeah, that's definitely.
You can't exit.
I have a few of those. Yep.
You know, they're
not growing, not exiting. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like it's like a lifestyle business for the founders.
Yeah, or they become a grant mill, right? They keep and you could do that in life sciences, right? You keep writing grants, you keep getting, you know, $300 to $1 million over a couple of years. There's no exit from that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's a grant mill. And the thing is, same is true of service businesses in my sector, right? I mean, you know, we're going to sell services to the pharmaceutical industry. Great. Who's going to buy that? Very, very few companies.
All right. Well, Michael, this was an amazing conversation. You're the first life sciences VC I've had on the pod, and I really appreciate you being my guinea pig and educating me and being patient with my stupid questions.
No, they're not stupid questions. No, I mean, not at all. Believe me, this is hard stuff, and it's very different from IT investing.
Yeah, it really is. And that's why I had you on the pod. It was such an enlightening conversation. I'm sure the audience will get a ton of value from it. So thanks again for coming on.
Sure. Happy to help. Take care.
Thanks, Michael.
Bye-bye.